WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of Americans are spending their evenings this week watching clips of the young Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, the Beatles, Aretha, James Brown, and other music greats. PBS is presenting its 10-part series on the history of rock and roll. It features great archival footage and interviews with performers as well as important behind-the-scenes figures. My guest, Robert Palmer, is the chief consultant to the series and author of the companion book, Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. He was the New York Times' first full-time rock critic. I asked Palmer if he wanted to challenge any aspects of rock and roll's official history.
Well, when it comes to television and documentaries about rock and roll, it seems like almost all of them have been parades of stars and hit records. And for every record that we know and every artist that we know and love, there are all these other people that had a really tremendously important input. There's studio musicians, there's record producers, there's recording engineers. In the case of some place like Motown, there were dance instructors, there was the Charm School. All these people that were involved in these aspects, you know, they're really a part of the rock and roll story, and that's one aspect that we really did go after in this series, is to try to get you behind the scenes and show you how collaborations have produced most of what we think of as being rock and roll.
I'd like to ask you to choose a record that you would like to redeem, a record that you think hasn't been given the respect it deserves or hasn't been, you know, noticed in the way that it should have been.
Well, in the area of historical sort of, you know, 50s period, early 60s, you know, in that classic period, one guy that's badly in need of redemption is Ike Turner. Ike Turner is famous these days for abusing Tina, and that's about it. And he really was a key player in the beginnings of rock and roll. He was an influential disc jockey in the South. He was one of the early rhythm and blues record producers. He produced all these great records by B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf, and recorded all these people for little independent labels, often out of his home in Clarksdale. This was in the early 50s. And then he started his band, the Kings of Rhythm, out of the Mississippi Delta, and they moved to St. Louis. And before he took on Tina, they had made some absolutely incredible records that featured Ike Turner's guitar playing, and he was the first really crazed sonic rock and roll guitar player, I think. He was the guy that discovered that you could really torture a guitar with a whammy bar and break and shatter all the notes, and it just, he made some amazing records and has not at all gotten his due. That's why on one of the several top tens I included at the end of the book, the companion book to the series, there's a Rhino CD called I Like Ike, The Best of Ike Turner, and I would recommend that to anybody that likes hot guitar solos and good electric blues-based rock and roll.
Well, let me ask you to choose an Ike Turner recording that you'd like us to play.
Let's see. There's a on that CD, there's one really funny cut on it called Taking Back My Name, in which Ike takes what the Rolling Stones copied from him and takes it back and copies them and outdoes the Rolling Stones on their own stylistic turf. That's a pretty amazing track to me.
Let's hear it.
Telling me sometime woman, I think you're plumb out of your head. All day long you feed my kids wieners and bread. Taking back my name, I'm moving the whole chain. Now get on down with it. Put me in the alley cause I left my snuff box at home.
Okay, well, that's Ike Turner, and my guest is Robert Palmer. He was the chief consultant to the PBS Rock and Roll History series that's currently being shown, and he also wrote the companion book, Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. Robert, let me ask you to redeem somebody else for us.
Well, there's a vocal group called the Five Royales that has somehow sunk without a trace, even among vocal group fanatics, and yet during the 50s and into the early 60s, the Five Royales were probably the most influential rhythm and blues vocal group on the scene. They had a guitar player and songwriter named Loman Pauling, who, in addition to having been the guitarist who inspired later players like Steve Cropper from Booker T and the MGs, and Mac Rebeneck, Dr. John, has always sung the praises of Loman Pauling. And Loman Pauling also happens to be the guy that wrote some songs that I know that everyone's heard. This is dedicated to the one I love, made much more famous by the Shirelles. He wrote a song called Think that was made famous by James Brown and later by Aretha Franklin. He made some amazing records with that group, which was also about the most musicianly of all the 50s vocal groups. Those people could sing. There's a 2-CD Rhino anthology that's, again, on one of my top 10 lists that's called Monkey Hips and Rice, the Five Royales Anthology, and that's on Rhino. And that's an artist who's definitely in need of being reclaimed. I was so happy to be able to find a picture of Loman Pauling getting guitar feedback on stage at the Apollo in the 1950s, and that's in the book.
Let me ask you to choose a Five Royales track that you'd like us to play.
I would play Think.
Good.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Think about the sacrifices that I made for you. Think of all the time that I spent with you. Think of all the good things that I've done for you. Think of all the bad things I try not to do.
My guest is Robert Palmer, chief consultant to the PBS series on the history of rock and roll. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Palmer, author of the companion book to the PBS rock and roll series. Now, what's the point of rock and roll history where you enter as a listener?
That's the beginning of rock as we know it. I think everybody has their own rock and roll history, you know, that starts with the first music that they heard, and it develops not always in a linear progression, but sometimes going back into history as well as forward, you know. I mean, a lot of people come in at the point of listening to some contemporary artist and then sort of gradually get into discovering the roots, you know, possibly starting with the influences of the person that they first got turned on to. I think everybody has that that magic moment when the music rocked them for the first time.
And what was yours?
Mine would probably be the first Coasters hit record, Searchin' and Youngblood. I remember that coming on when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I had been hearing pre-rock and roll popular music on the radio for a few years prior to that, and I was very interested in music, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't that crazy about what was passing for pop music at the time. And then when I heard Searchin' by the Coasters, and a little after that I heard Ray Charles, and that was the music that really turned me around.
What spoke to you about it?
It's really hard to say. I think it was really the quality of the voices. It was the fact that these black singers, there was all these grit in their voices, and these kind of sounds like they were maybe ripping their vocal cords a little bit when they were singing. And it seemed to convey so much emotion and energy and excitement, you know, just the sound of the voices and the texture of the voices. And the way that the voices blended together had a kind of harmony that was not conventional harmony. It was something else. And it was, after having heard very conventional harmony, you know, all my life, having never heard blues or even any really down-home country and western music, but just kind of having heard that 50s white bread pop, the first time I heard black voices and black rhythms, I was just floored. And I probably never got over it.
Why don't we play the Coasters?
Okay, great. Gonna find her.
You grew up in Arkansas, and mm-hmm. Near Little Rock, is that?
Yeah, in Little Rock,
in
actually.
In Little Rock,
yeah.
Okay. And when you were coming of age, it was still segregated, I guess.
Very much so. I personally integrated, in reverse, all the black rhythm and blues shows that came to the auditorium in Little Rock, starting when I was 15 years old, and that was in 1960. There were no integrated shows in Arkansas, and I was the first white kid to start showing up at all the black shows, and it was such a novelty that nobody thought to stop me, even though I was only 15 years old, and I was going in these places where people were drinking and pulling knives and all sorts of things, you know. But I was able to go in and hear people like Sam Cooke and, you know, Otis Redding, Solomon Burke, all these great, great people. And that really was what got me started in the music, was going to those shows. I really rarely missed one. And, you know, by the time I was college age, there were, several more local white kids going to the shows. But there was only me to begin with. And then when I was in college, I was the only white musician in an otherwise all-black band that played around almost entirely in black joints. So I had a real sort of involvement in black music and black culture that I really think it was possible because I grew up in Arkansas at that particular time. And all of those developments, I was, you know, right on the cutting edge. I've been around long enough that I was able to be first with all that kind of stuff in town. And consequently, I didn't really ever have much trouble, you know, getting into those shows. It was several years later that I first started going to white rock shows, probably about 1965, before I ever went to a Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, and that was to see the Yardbirds.
No, I grew up in Brooklyn and used to go to see the Murray the K rock and roll shows. Murray the K was a great New York disc jockey. And there'd be a mix of acts, or black acts and white acts sharing the same bill, and lots of black teenagers and white kids in the audience. And I guess there was nothing like that when you were growing up in
Arkansas. Well, that was the great promise of rock and roll, that it was supposed to be like that, you know. And I think that it was small independent labels that were putting out most of the music in the 50s. And, you know, as soon as the sort of major corporate labels could reassert control, it went back to being segregated shows again. I mean, the shows that I saw in Little Rock were shows that were all black acts and were for black people only. And yet, if I had been going to those shows in the mid-50s and seeing a lot of the same artists, and it had been Brooklyn, that would have been billed as a rock and roll show. But below the Mason-Dixon line, it was rhythm and blues and strictly for black people.
You know, one of the dramas of the early days of rock and roll was that, you know, the parents and the PTA groups were afraid of the effect it was going to have on the youth. And, of course, all the rock and roll movies of the 50s and early 60s mm-hmm. really exploit that. You have something interesting in your group that's a kind of much darker version of that, and that is a racial fear about the music. You know, instead of like, oh, rock and roll, our kids are going to learn to do lewd dancing. It's like, oh, rock and roll, black music is going to infect our white children. You reprint a pamphlet that I'd actually like to read. This was from New Orleans?
Yeah, the New Orleans White Citizens Council.
Yeah, the White Supremacist Citizens Council of Greater New Orleans. So it says, stop. Help save the youth of America. Don't buy Negro records. If you don't want to serve Negroes in your place of business, then do not have Negro records on your jukebox or listen to Negro records on the radio. The screaming, idiotic words and savage music of these records are undermining the morals of our white youth in America. Call the advertisers of the radio stations that play this type of music and complain to them. Don't let your children buy or listen to these Negro records. Were you exposed to anything like that in Arkansas?
Yeah, I think that you were aware of that. You know, I did have some trouble with the Citizens Council in Little Rock at one point. I had bricks thrown through my window and attempted to set my parents' house on fire.
Because you went to concerts of black musicians?
Because I went to black concerts, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have anybody to go with?
Not at first. I made a lot of friends, though. I had a lot of black friends. I sort of totally withdrew from white society in Arkansas for a while there, and I went out, and my girlfriends were black. The women that I dated were black from pretty much all through high school and into college.
So rock and roll for you also introduced you to a different culture in America.
Very much so.
Are there any groups or particular records that you really love now that you overlooked in their own time?
Yeah, I think that you always miss a few records, and that's what I find so problematic about top 10 lists. When it's time to make up a top 10 list for the year, for example, I've found in looking over my old top 10 list that maybe half the things on it have really lasted, and half were things that were much more exciting in the context of the time than they are 5 or 10 years later. I think that's natural, and I think that a lot of rock and roll, it is pop music, and it is, supposed to have something to say about the time in which it's made. And you know, capturing the sort of flavor of the moment and having qualities that are going to last are not necessarily going to be the same thing. When I was a lot younger, I tended to like Flash a lot more, and I tended to be a lot more interested in instrumental playing, in, you know, guitar solos and, saxophones, whatever, rhythm section playing. The older I get, the more I love the human voice, and the more my values in music go toward being about really excellent singing. And that wasn't always the case.
Well, Robert Palmer, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. It was great to be here.
Robert Palmer is the chief consultant to the PBS series Rock and Roll. He wrote the companion book, Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. This is Ray Charles.
I awaken, oh, this morning, and I was filled with despair. All my dreams turned to ashes and gone. And as I looked back on my life, it was barren and bad, and without love, I have nothing, I have nothing at all.
This is Fresh Air.